Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I often get referred to as former schoolgirl in the media. Which is quite humorous, because aren't we all?
Yes, that's right. I'm a former schoolgirl.
Yeah. Former schoolgirl, Julia Gillard. Yeah.
I'm so excited to kick off this new season of the podcast with a conversation with activist, author, sexual consent champion, and a voice for her generation, Chanel Kontos. Chanel was a catalyst for transforming how consent education works in Australia. I always find it so incredibly interesting to have a conversation with Chanel, and the one we recorded for the podcast is no different. For me, in my 60s, to be talking to a feminist in her 20s helps me get a whole new perspective on how she's seeing issues, the people she's working with, campaigning with, her friends, her social cohort are seeing issues. And I find it so refreshing to get the sense about how deeply thoughtful she is about her feminism, and I know that she's not alone in that. I do hope that the conversation resonates with you in similar ways. It was really very good fun to record. Before we dive into today's conversation, please be aware that this episode covers themes of consent and sexual violence, and parts of this conversation may be distressing for some listeners. If this brings up anything for you, help is available by contacting the 24-hour National Counselling Service 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732, and you can find further resources in the show notes. Chanel, welcome to a podcast of one's own. I'm so delighted to be talking with you this afternoon, and it was lovely to catch up for lunch last week. We've talked from time to time about your family and your upbringing, but I haven't asked you this question before. When was the first time you noticed boys and girls were treated differently?
I think I've always inherently understood that boys and girls were treated differently, but I guess it was more of a moment of understanding that we shouldn't be. And I honestly think it happened from quite young. I've got brothers, and kind of seeing the different expectations and norms of us in the house, with like really small things to really large things. And I also think a big part of it was, I guess for me, from as young as I can kind of remember, like I guess 5 years old or something, I always understood that I was a girl, and that meant that there were things that boys could do to me, and that made us different in a certain way. And I've kind of always been aware of that to an extent.
And by that you mean that there was a threat for girls that wasn't there for boys?
Yeah. And, you know, that's tangibly expressed through things my brothers would have been allowed to do that I wouldn't have been able to do because of, you know, my parents trying to keep us safe or whatever, things like that. And then also from even younger, just understanding that men and boys could be a threat in different ways. So kind of I've forever modified my behaviour in different ways in the presence of men in order to mitigate that. Yeah, it's just been there forever. But I think the kind of, I guess when you get to teen years and you start kind of rebelling is when it was much more like, well, why is this? Like, why is that the case? And, you know, different rules for the girls' schools and boys' schools about what they could do. I actually remember in primary school, girls weren't allowed to wear pants in winter, and we only had dresses, and like we would always be really cold. And I actually think my mum wrote a letter and made it that all the girls were allowed to wear pants. So yeah, even just things like that.
That is
crazy. That sounds like the kind of thing that comes from my era. I mean, we've talked in the past about the age difference between us because you came to my 60th birthday and I've put on a few years since then. And you're how old?
I'm almost 26.
Almost 26. So that is...
I feel like I'm getting old. I'm starting to have existential crisis problems.
You got a lot of years yet, but that... You know, something about school uniforms and girls wearing pants could be in the lived memory of a woman who's 26. That is truly concerning.
It is. And I think the school kind of changed it, you know, straight away, like as soon as it was kind of brought to their attention. But I guess the fact that they just didn't stock a winter school uniform for girls that included trousers, and we're actually allowed to then wear them all year round, which is very exciting.
Good thing. Now, you are known for sounding the alarm on the epidemic of rape culture in Sydney's private schools, and you've talked already about your time at school and how you clearly had the sense that there was something wrong with a world where you were responsible for guarding your own safety. But can you talk to us about the moment that turned from something that you were thinking into activism?
Yeah, so there were kind of actually a few moments that led to the point of ultimately posting something on social media and launching Teacher's Consent. The first moment was when I was in year 10 and we had consent education for the first time at school, and this man came into our school and started defining sexual assault and telling us what acts counted as acts of, you know, indecent assault, sexual harassment, things like this. And it was honestly mind-blowing to be my friends, because these acts that were being described were things that we had all either seen or that had happened to us or that had happened to, you know, one of our literal best friends. And I like to think my activism for consent education started then, because me and two of my best friends, Kyla and Lily, went straight to a teacher at the school the next day and said, that was incredible, but we needed it earlier, basically. And, you know, we were told that the parents would never let it and, you know, we're too young and blah, 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 and we can't have these conversations. It's not appropriate. And we gave up. And then I guess the other moments that came from then were fast forward 7 or so years, and me and 3 other friends who were basically gossiping about men who had done things to us or other people. And we literally went on all night naming acts that men that we knew and still socialise with, or that our friends still socialise with, things that they had done to other people we knew when we were younger. And in that moment, when I told my own story of sexual assault, one of my friends who was there was like, oh no, that didn't happen to you, like that happened to one of our other friends. And I was like, no, like it definitely happened to me. And I basically found out that that same boy who had perpetrated sexual assault against me had sexually assaulted another one of my friends a year later. And then suddenly it felt this thing of like, oh my God, I could have stopped, I could have done something, like I could have reported him, like all these sort of things, which was kind of the catalyst for first collecting testimonies, because I just knew all of my friends had them. And at first I just kind of reached out to individual people and asked them to send me their stories, which they did. And I collected about 20 or something. And then I got quite sidetracked. I got into my master's, I moved to London, I just like got busy and started doing other things. And then again, when I was doing my master's, I started thinking so much about these things and learning about these concepts like sexual coercion. And actually, I think you'll find this interesting. So we had this group project and it was on sexual coercion. And someone went before me and said that when they were growing up, virginity testing was part of their experience at school. For anyone listening who doesn't know virginity testing, it's also known as like the two-finger test, and it's to check if a hymen is still intact. So it's quite a invasive form of misogyny and sexism and purity culture, and it's also, you know, not scientifically proven in any way. You can't measure virginity. Anyway, whole different, we can do a whole different podcast on that. But I went next and I felt quite taken aback, and I was saying like, oh, you know, nothing like that ever happened to me at school. I was very privileged. I grew up in Australia. And then I said, but when reading about sexual coercion, I was realizing that on weekends, sexual assault was common practice. And I was met with more shock by this group than the woman who had gone before me, because they were all saying, how could this happen in Australia? Like, we thought Australia was a safe place. So that was also a moment where I was like, God, I really should do something about this. And then, yeah, I ended up a few weeks later, in a moment of anger, posting on Instagram the question, have you or has anyone close to you ever been sexually assaulted by someone who went to an all-boys school in Sydney? And then from there, it just took a life of its own.
And the life of its own was literally thousands of testimonies flowing into you, written by girls, young women, telling you what had happened to them. I mean, how did you react to that? I mean, one, in the sense that it must have been traumatic to be confronted with story after story about what had happened. The sheer reading of it would have taken a toll on you. But also, this was, were you astonished that the volume that came to you was as high as it was?
I mean, I wasn't surprised because I was there, I grew up with it, I saw it. But I was astonished by how many people were willing to put it on a public platform purely for the benefit of the next generation. And I also think a lot of people felt a lot of closure and healing from kind of doing that process. But yeah, I'm not going to lie, I was pretty messed up. Like, I didn't know what vicarious trauma was at the time, which I now do know what it is because I basically experienced from reading these, in detail accounts. And the reason I had to read them was because I was the one publishing them, and the defamation risk fell on me. And Australia has very strict defamation laws that consistently silence women. Again, a whole other podcast we could do on that. And there was also an incredible team of people who ended up volunteering their time to help with reviewing testimonies for defamation. But I think the effects of reading thousands of testimonies of sexual assault kind of changes the way that you perceive the world forever a little bit.
In the sense that you see threat more clearly?
I feel like I've always been cautious of, being in dark spaces or walking home alone or blah, 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 as, again, every single woman ever has been. And that's still the case. But actually, no, more so changes the way I perceive people that I don't see as a threat. Because a lot of these testimonies at the beginning, when it was just my Instagram and when it was like kind of the very beginning of that grassroots movement, they were coming to me from girls I knew. Therefore, they would tell me the name of the boys who I also knew. And it was this weird, I don't even know what it was, trying to compartmentalize or trying to like process the fact that this person could do this, but then they can also be this person. And that's, I think, given me a lot of trust issues with men in general, because even if someone is perfectly lovely and great, it can be like, oh, but then that can also happen.
Yeah, the ultimate challenge really, isn't it, to what we know are the wrong stereotypes, and the wrong stereotypes so routinely used in the media and in, movies and TV and fiction, the stereotype that sexual assault is about the dark street woman walking alone, the predator comes out of the shadows, whereas routinely it is someone you know and someone that you trusted or liked or you've seen do good things in the world, but there's also this.
Yeah, and I think it also, in a weird way, and I don't want this to come across the wrong way because I'm not excusing, but reading that also, I think, helped me understand why these boys were perpetrating in this way. You could kind of like see where the things went wrong. You know, you could see people express a freeze or fawn trauma response that a young boy who potentially doesn't know any better or has been socialized with an extreme amount of sexual entitlement. You can see why then they mistake that for consent or mistake that as a thing that is okay. Or, you know, a lot of the testimonies would say things like he was the last in his group to not have sex and all his friends were paying him out about it and things like that. And you can kind of understand why maybe this young boy, who we cannot forget is a child himself as well, is experiencing these pressures externally from friends, from pornography, from, I don't know, movies, like whatever it is, and then pushing that onto the person that is in front of them in that moment.
And you channeled all of this into the movement known as Teach Us Consent. So clearly this was viral, it was getting media interest, you had these, you know, incredibly powerful, brave testimonies from literally thousands of people. Can you talk to me about the process that takes you from that into a very focused campaign to say that the curriculum should be changed so that students in Australia, boys, girls, everyone, should learn about what consent is?
The intention was to get my old school and the nearby schools that I thought the principals might meet with me for, to get them to teach consent. The testimonies were always posted alongside the petition to try to promote people to sign the petition. And then once we started, when it was on Instagram, it's so funny, like I can't believe thinking back on it how chaotic it was, but it was on like a Google Doc and then it was on Google Forms at one point, and then we like, it was glitching so hard because so many people were on it and submitting things at the same time and the file was too big to, it was actual chaos. And then eventually a friend of mine, Jack Pascoe, messaged me saying you need a website and just like built it for us over the weekend, which was incredible. And then Teachers Consent started, and when we were writing the top of it, it was like, well, this is so much bigger now than just, you know, me and my friends' experiences and the people from this select group of schools in Sydney. Like, we're getting testimonies from all over Australia and we know this is everywhere. Not that I ever didn't think it was everywhere, I just never even for a second thought the change could go that far. And we were just like, well, may as well go for it. So we made a petition to mandate consent education Australia, like the whole country. And yeah, it got almost 50,000 signatures in a really short period of time and made it so politicians were listening, teachers were listening, principals were listening, parents were listening. And I think having that really clear ask from day one and kind of never pivoting from that was definitely one of the reasons the campaign was so successful.
And you won. And you won incredibly quickly. You know, given how we measure social movements, often it takes decades and decades and decades to see change. And yet this was incredibly quick and persuasive for governments of all political stripes. I mean, why do you think it, you know, punched through? Because it would have been pretty easy, I think, for political leaders to either fall back on the, you know, it's not our job to write the curriculum, we leave that to experts, or, yeah, sure, we're going to do sex education, consent education, but not until children are, you know, this age and this stage of development, not realising, of course, that the statistics now tell us that, you know, children under 10 accessing violent pornography because that's possible.
Yeah. I think about this a lot. I think about like the success of Teachers Consent and why it's successful a lot. So first of all, we have the structural aspect of it, which we have you to thank for, Julia, because Australia has only had a national curriculum for, what now, 12 years or something, but at this point, 10 years. Because you implemented, which we realised the other day, which is so funny, crazy what can happen a decade later.
It was a full circle moment. Yeah, that was one of the reforms when I was Minister for Education. And of course, I didn't sit down and write the national curriculum. We had some wonderful experts and a federal state working group on it. But yes, we did make a national curriculum back then.
One thing that was like super lucky, stars aligned, I'm always very thankful for is that the Australian curriculum only gets reviewed and updated once every 5 years. And by just like a really, really, really good chance and coincidence, it was currently being updated at the point. But I think there's a few things. I think we were always so intentional to be kind of apolitical in this and just refuse to get pulled into different sides or debates or, you know, any sort of polarization. Like, we continuously say this is a human rights issue, not a political issue. But another massive aspect of the campaign, of course, the testimonies and the numbers, just the sheer, the vulnerability of, again, thousands of people. But such a large aspect of the campaign for me was working with incredible women in media who didn't, you know, clickbait the title, didn't try to sensationalize it, didn't try to politicize it, just really genuinely wrote the best articles they could reporting on this movement.
And what about your own treatment in the media or by the public? I mean, very, very quickly you went from here I am in London and I'm studying my master's, and then you're the public face and the centre of this incredible campaign, doing media interviews, meeting political leaders. I mean, personally, what was it like?
It was really weird. I mean, I feel like, again, kind of the same as the vicarious trauma. I didn't even have time to process it at the time because it just happened so fast. Like, I couldn't be like, oh my God, I just did a live TV interview with Sunrise, because I was already on the Today Show 5 minutes later. So it just like wasn't, there was no room for kind of reflection. Yeah. And then my treatment in the media, I think overall, touch wood, I don't want to jinx it, but I think I've gotten, it shouldn't be lucky. I shouldn't say lucky. It should be the norm. But I've had only a few, like, notably negative experiences working with media or being portrayed in media or things being written about me in media. But something that is quite funny is I often get referred to as former schoolgirl in the media, which is quite humorous because aren't we all?
Yes, that's right. I'm a former schoolgirl too.
Former schoolgirl, Julia Gillard. Yeah. Maybe you should request that to be a title change from former Prime Minister.
Say actually, former schoolgirl and former Prime Minister.
Let's go back. which I don't think that would happen to a boy. I've never seen a boy be referred to as former schoolboy in the media for years on when they have three university degrees, run their own organisation and are an expert in their field.
And what about social media?
Social media is an interesting one. I guess I'm, you know, social media native, whatever it's called, a generation that grew up with it. And I think we've been conditioned to think that if you have a public profile, you're opening yourselves up to criticism and comments and, you know, quite vile ones often, which shouldn't be the case and isn't the case. But because I've always existed in that online space, I'm so used to getting horrific messages from men from when I was, you know, really young to now. But yeah, I definitely get way, way, way worse comments on social media than any sort of formal media. I know it should bother me, but it actually just genuinely doesn't bother me, and I'm glad it doesn't bother me. But, you know, rape threats, like death threats, like you're too ugly to rape, or like, you know, just the everything you can imagine. And it upsets me thinking that other people see that as well and maybe think that it's then okay to say these things. So maybe I should delete them and report them more. But it's almost like I keep them there to be like, well, you're actually the exact reason I'm doing all of this stuff.
It's great that you've got that sense of defiance about it. Mm. I mean, I think women react to it in various ways. I mean, I think there's your sense of defiance. Some women avert their eyes. They don't manage their own social media accounts. Certainly when I was Prime Minister, I wasn't looking at my own social media account, which is probably just as well, given what would have been on it. Mm. You know, I've interviewed Mary Beard, the classicist, on this podcast, and she's reached out to people who've said the most vile things to her on social media and gone and had a cup of coffee with them to talk it through. Different reactions, but obviously at baseline it should just not be happening. Mm. Now, you have recently published your first book, Consent Laid Bare. Did you see what I did there?
First book. I like that. It's optimistic. I like it.
many more to come, which should be compulsory reading for everyone. And it's in the title and we've been talking about it. But tell me what you mean by consent. You provide a really insightful definition in the book that challenges what people typically think when that word is used. And I'd really like to hear it now.
Yes, this was actually inspired by an incredible woman who does on-the-ground consent education delivery in the Northern Rivers. And she pointed out to me that the etymology of the word consent, so con means together, and sent comes from the Latin sentio, which means feeling. And that felt like the first time I'd been satisfied with the definition of consent. You know, when you're looking at it in just legal terms, it just doesn't make sense. And then when you just say, you know, agreeing to do something, it's just not enough for me thinking about how much more agreeable women are when they don't want to be because they've been socialized to be. And even, you know, large societal taboos around our own sexualities and pleasures and things like that, what that then means for consent in a moment to not be centering our own experience or our own desires. So yeah, this idea of feeling together almost kind of gave me like a lot of closure in thinking about like, what is this topic? What does it mean? And I think I liked it so much because a lot of the work I do, and a strong theme throughout the book, is this kind of idea of the trade-off between empathy and entitlement. And right now in a rape culture, we have it so that entitlement to women's bodies outweighs the empathy that boys and men feel towards women. But if we put that empathy scale upwards, then sexual assault would be a complete anomaly, because you couldn't accidentally violate someone's consent, or you, even if you weren't taught what consent was, you would inherently understand what is appropriate behaviour in a situation. So yeah, this idea of feeling together and being empathetic, and the intimacy that that definition also provided, I put that at the beginning of the book to, I guess, set up how the rest of the book would flow and what I was talking about when I was bringing up these hard to answer questions, like, you know, well, what actually is consent? Can women consent under a patriarchy? All of these nuanced things that I don't actually have the answer to, but just to put that umbrella of context over it.
Beautifully said.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You talk in the book about the idea of rape culture pyramid. How would you describe that to people? I mean, I think a lot of people in all sorts of contexts find it hard to latch onto the concept of a culture or a systemic manifestation. People like to think, whether it's rape or gender inequality more broadly, that maybe there are just a few bad actors, but generally people are good, rather than understanding this in a more systemic frame. Mm. So can you help us understand that?
Yeah, and also just before I do, this idea that it's only a few bad actors, there actually are, you know, more men who don't rape than men who do rape, but that doesn't mean that it's not having significant societal impacts, and it doesn't mean that the men who don't rape aren't doing things that can contribute and allow the men who do to do so. But basically, start with defining rape culture. So a rape culture is a sociological setting where sexual assault and harassment are pervasive and normalized due to society's expectations of and attitudes towards gender and sexuality. So that was a big sentence, but if you think about the word normalized here, that's kind of like what's key. It means that acts of sexual violence can occur without people thinking too much of it. And the way that that happens is through the rape culture pyramid, is a helpful way to understand. So if you think about a triangle, or like the shape of a pyramid, and then the bottom layer of that pyramid being things like misogynistic comments, you know, saying things like a prime minister shouldn't be a woman, for example, or like that's a really good job for a woman, or sexist attitudes and these kind of things that are consistently all around us, literally all day, every day. And then the next layer on top of that is maybe a catcall, wolf whistles, forms of sexual harassment that I think the most recent survey was that 97% of women in the UK had experienced street sexual harassment. And then again, more severe forms, so unsolicited sexual images being sent to you, or image-based abuse, so your images being sent to other people, which then allows more severe forms and insidious forms of sexual violence to occur, like stealthing, which is the non-consensual removal of a condom during sex. And then I guess the very tippy top of the pyramid is rape and sexual assault. And those higher up levels can't exist without the bottom levels happening. It wouldn't be okay to send on someone's naked image to someone else if it wasn't okay to make sexist comments about them. I think with, you know, human beings, these acts will always occur. Unfortunately, there'll always be a small part of the population intentionally perpetrating them. But the idea is that in a rape culture, this kind of like middle ground person who can be influenced by their surroundings for better or for worse are the ones who see this, think it's okay, or see others acknowledge and accept this behaviour, and then it excuses it in themselves for what they do to other people.
That's very well explained. Thank you. When we're considering, you know, all of this, one thing that keeps going through my mind is at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, and more generally, there's been a lot of polling and information and research delving into the attitudes of young men compared with older cohorts of men. For many women who think about gender equality, are active on gender equality, there's been an assumption in the back of our minds that each coming generation is more progressive on gender equality than the generations before. So to completely stylize it, if you talk to a 90-year-old man and he was expressing some very old-fashioned sexist attitudes, a woman's place is in the home, well, you might say to yourself, well, you know, kind of I get that, you know, given how long he's lived and the sort of society he grew up in, but I won't hear things like that from a 15-year-old, you know, they're much more progressive. And yet this research is telling us that whether it's on gender-based violence or other topics, there is not a majority, but a significant cohort of young men who have more misogynistic attitudes than men my age. Have you got I mean, no one knows, you know, we haven't done the evaluative research work yet, but have you got any theory about why that might be? Do you have a sense of that from all this work you've done?
I would say I think social media is big because of algorithms and the kind of increased polarisation of views. It's so creepy if you sign up to TikTok and say you're an 18-year-old boy, you will get fed content of girls, you know, in school uniform, which is obviously fine, but, you know, doing dances, and it's like, well, why is that the first thing that comes up on a screen? You'll get content about Andrew Tate, you'll get content, you know, very kind of like sexualized content of female bodies, you'll get ads for things such as deepfake technology, which is when you can, it's like Photoshop, but a moving Photoshop, and with AI technology developing so quickly, like extremely realistic depictions of often pornographic content or very sexualized content, which, by the way, the technology has only really evolved to create for female bodies, which is just like indicative of the misogyny in there. And then we were also speaking about this at lunch the other day, that basically men are way more likely to vote right-wing and women are way more likely to vote left-wing around the world. And that split occurred around 2017, which is when the Me Too movement kind of exploded and feminist ideas became kind of commonplace in discussions, and women, I think, felt the confidence to seek out and fight for their own rights more. But I think also what it just speaks to is that we are really failing young men. What do we need to give them to make them feel comfortable with the ideas of feminism? Why are they turning to characters like Andrew Tate? Why can't we offer them an alternative or feed that need just as well with healthy role models of masculinity or with, you know, productive conversations? And oh, it's really scary and it's really disheartening. I also think pornography is a big aspect in this. We know there's correlation between the amount of pornography that someone consumes and, for example, how likely they are to choke someone without asking for consent during sex, or how less likely they are to intervene if they see someone be sexually assaulted, if they've been watching this sort of content.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. There is so much to think about in terms of different and positive images of masculinity, because there are these Andrew Tates and others who are, yeah, filling that void with an image of masculinity which is really defined around a man or a boy's capacity to subjugate and exploit women or girls. And we need a complete reframe. I mean, it's one of the things at the Global Institute, we're very interested in following through. There's a lot to think about. Maybe there is this sense of being left behind or isolated in young men, and they're finding ways of addressing it which are very counterproductive to the project of gender equality.
Yeah, I think that struggle for power is actually such an important point in this. And there's that quote, the equality feels like oppression to the privileged. For my book, I was researching like unsolicited sexual images and kind of like why those are so commonplace to receive one, or like why it's so common to send one. So essentially it was an academic article on like unsolicited dick pics. And the kind of consensus of it was that it was a struggle for power in a day and age where lots of men feel as though they've lost power in the courting process as such, because it's much more common for a woman to ask a man on a date, or, you know, for them to have more autonomy. Or apparently that action was often done in an attempt to kind of reinstate that gendered hierarchy. And like, as a reminder, it's like, no, actually, you're not in charge. You're not safe. You can be in your bedroom at home in the safest place in the world, and like, I can still get to you. And that really creeped me out.
Mm. Yeah. That is, I think, very insightful, but very creepy is the right word. You open the book with the mantra, and I love this, be ruthless with systems and kind on people. I think they're fantastic words. And I'd very much like to say that's kind of the approach we take at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, where we're focused on systems and the way in which they impact positively or negatively women's opportunities and choices. And fortunately, you've joined us at the dual team at the Australian National University, and you've brought together an incredible group of young activists for our new youth committee. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's really exciting.
It is so exciting. And they are actually just genuinely the most incredible bunch of people. Like, you know, put all of their kind of like projects and achievements aside, the passion and like authenticity and critical thinking, and they're just amazing. And I guess the point of this was aligned with the Global Institute for Women's Leadership strategy of onboarding youth more and engaging with them more, and not just trying to get our research and our ideas out to them, but also hear from the youth of Australia and beyond what they want us to be doing, because it's really their future that we're shaping here. So we actually had our first youth summit last year in October, which was really exciting and incredible to have people in a room together. If for nothing else, just being able to connect these young people and encourage them to work together and kind of see things that sprout from that in different ways.
And when you're thinking about those young people that you're working with, I mean, you know, when they look around at today's world, there are certainly many, many challenges, you know, war, climate change, poverty, the loss of trust in politics, even democracy, gender inequality, racism, the list goes on and on. I think for all of us, but I suspect particularly for young people, it can be hard to have hope. Mm. You know, they must be looking and thinking, we're going to inherit this big mess. Mm. What gives you hope as you look out on the world?
I think young people are carving out their own ways to create hope. Like, maybe there's extreme distrust in politics, but okay, well then maybe we don't engage with politics anymore. Maybe we do our own social media petitions, or maybe we, you know, hold our own grassroots organisations or our own events, and just making things happen themselves and moving away from that old power system of, you know, being quite exclusive and traditionally male and traditionally white and inaccessible to a general person, because it's, you know, it's one building in Canberra where these decisions are being made, and being like, all right, well, let's redistribute that power and let's make it so that a young person's voice can be just as impactful as someone who's sitting in the Australian Senate. And yeah, that gives me hope, seeing it be successful and happen all the time.
Absolutely. Now I'm going to come to the regular questions that I ask my guest, and I'm going to start with, what is the worst misogyny you've ever experienced?
How do you pick one, honestly? Which is the messed up thing. I mean, okay, yeah, obviously, you know, various sexual assaults throughout my life have been the most like insidious, most overt form of misogyny I've experienced. But actually thinking about it, I was speaking with my friend Bianca about this before, and she had a good phrase to that she used. It was death by a thousand cuts. Just kind of like being a teenage girl and getting called the word slut, the word bitch, the being in school uniform and like consistently being catcalled by like grown men who were driving past in cars. The consistent like microaggressions of misogyny that were just like ever present, the way boys interacted with me, the way they spoke about me, the way they spoke about me to me or to other people. And this was also actually, so these years that I'm thinking of were those years that you were prime minister. It was kind of like 2010, 2013, around that era. So also, you know, going home and TV being on and then seeing extreme misogyny against a woman and everyone thinking it was normal. You know, not blinking an eyelid, just eating my dinner and not thinking anything of it. No kind of critical conversations around that. Consistently seeing in the paper, you know, talking about what clothes someone's wearing and then thinking like, okay, well, then I should be worried about what clothes I'm wearing. So I think that the worst misogyny I ever experienced in my life was actually just being a teenage girl, which is quite devastating because I think that we can all relate.
Yeah, great answer. Only 13% of women who are sexually assaulted report it to police, and just 1.5% of reported sexual assaults result in a conviction. Mm. What's your reaction to those statistics?
1.5% of reported sexual assaults result in a conviction. That means we have essentially decriminalised rape in Australia. Simple as that. So another testament of rape culture. I'm not surprised at all. Like, I'm surprised 13% of women report sexual assaults. I even think that if you zoom back and look at the drastic lack of education in this space of what even constitutes sexual assault, there would also be millions of women who don't even know that things like maybe that, you know, their husband can sexually assault you and that marriage isn't consent, or that someone that you've slept with before isn't consent in the future, or that if you're intoxicated you can't, or that oral sex counts as a form of sexual assault in Australian jurisdictions. And those two stats next to each other, it's kind of like, well, then why would you? Like, what's the point? And I think it speaks to a need for, one, alternative reporting options for victim survivors, which I've actually done a project with New South Wales Police on this, and it was wildly successful. There was something like a 61% month-on-month increase in reports of sexual assault in New South Wales, which is unprecedented, when you give people that alternative, anonymous, not formal option, but putting it on like a formal site. And then also I think we really need to talk about alternative justice options because, yeah, the criminal justice system fails to bring justice, especially against particular types of groups, and then disproportionately prosecutes other types of people. And I really think that, again, when we're talking about these kind of like teen on teen perpetrated out of entitlement and a lack of education and because they've been like brainwashed by pornography, we're still talking about children. And it's like, how much do we, like, the criminal system is no place for children. But then how do we balance that with the fact that that then means no accountability? So I think the fact that in most places in the world, the options are either, you know, try to take your perpetrator to jail, and if they don't get a guilty conviction and go to jail, then no one will ever believe you and you actually lied about that and that was a false accusation, or absolutely no accountability is a really strong pillar that upholds rape culture. There's no room for nuance there. There's no room for apology. There's no room for looking to the future and trying to do better and acknowledging that something that happened when you were 15 was horrible and you shouldn't have done it to that person, and thinking I could apologise to them, give that closure, and then move on and learn and do better. There's this extreme stigma around sexual assault and rape, both for victims, but also for pointing at a perpetrator and naming them.
So alternate justice pathways, very important part of it. And you've done so much work and thinking around all of that. Finally, Virginia Woolf. Virginia says, you cannot find peace by avoiding life. Chanel Contos says,
be ruthless with systems and be kind to people.
That too is a very good quote. Thank you so much. That's been a fabulous conversation.
Thank you so much, Julie. It's such a privilege to come on the podcast, and I'm so proud to be working at Juul.
We're very, very happy to have you.
A podcast of One's Own is created by the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at the Australian National University, Canberra, with support from our sister institute at King's College, London. Earnings from the podcast go back into funding for the institute, which was founded by our host, Julia Gillard, and brings together rigorous research, practice and advocacy as a powerful force to advance gender equality and promote fair and equal access to leadership. Research and production for this podcast is by Becca Shepherd, Alice Higgins and Alina Ecott, with editing by Liz Keane from Headline Productions and recording support by Nick Hilton. If you have feedback or ideas, please email us at giwl@anu.edu.au. To stay up to date with the Institute's work, go to giwl.anu.edu.au and sign up to our updates or follow us on social media at JewelANU. You can also find A Podcast of One's Own on Instagram. The team at A Podcast of One's Own acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.